Hello, I'm Bill Sisson, Executive Director of WBCSD North America, and welcome to another edition of Transformative Leadership in Business. I'm being joined today by Shivaram Rajgopal, who is the Roy Bernard Kester and T.W. Burns Professor of Accounting and Auditing at Columbia Business School, which I think brings a very relevant dimension to our discussions these days. Shiva's knowledge and many significant contributions in this field of accounting are well recognized by leading business media, publications, journals, and the like. Shiva, thank you for taking the time to join me today.
Absolute pleasure, Bill. Thank you.
Today's discussion is to try to get a firsthand understanding of how the accounting and sustainability fields are starting to merge together. It's not a compliance exercise per se, but as a way to really understand how sustainability information shows up in a company's cash flows, risk profile, and valuation. These are the days when disclosure that signaled good intentions and virtues, these days are essentially over. Sustainability professionals are being asked by their boards, by their CFOs, by their CEOs to connect their work directly to business performance. I think that makes total sense given this day and age we find ourselves in, but how that should manifest in today's financial reporting and sustainability frameworks, of which there are many, is unclear. So this is something that we're going to take Shiva into our space and discuss today. So Shiva, I'm looking very forward to getting into this with you today. I had the really great fortune of being introduced to you by Bob Eccles, who we both know well, as one of the original thinkers and voices on integrated sustainability reporting, and that publishes many articles these days on moving sustainability from values to value. And I also come to learn that you and Bob are doing some really interesting work in this space. So let's get into it with you first. Give us a little bit of a background on yourself in the accounting fields, but more importantly, how you've gotten engaged in this conversation around linking sustainability ESG data with a company's performance.
Yeah, Bob, our common friend. I just got an email from him at 4 a.m. You know, he works harder than I do, which is incredible. But I often joke, Bob doesn't have a real job unlike me. But having said that, let's kind of come back. So by training, I'm a chartered accountant, which is like a CPA, perhaps, in the UK, India, Commonwealth kind of world. So I have a PhD in accounting. How did I come to ESG? Mostly as a skeptic. You know, I have like dozens of papers arguing that people don't walk the talk. Those were the days, remember? They would put out targets, aspirational goals, stretch numbers. And then by and large, if you went and checked things, there was nothing much going on. And then, of course, the mood turned, the politics changed, and suddenly, you know, maybe it was time to make sustainability boring again. And that's what we're trying to do in this book. So let me maybe make this a bit more real. So in a classroom, what would I do? For the sake of an argument, let's say we just pick an oil and gas company and we pull out their 10K. And for folks who are outside the US, that's our jargon for an annual report. And in a 10K, a company usually lists every single risk factor that might cause either a decline in revenue or an increase in costs or some kind of unrecognized liability. And these are usually written by very defensive lawyers. And as the story progresses, I'll tell you why that's important, because this is a data set that's coming from somebody who's not a sustainability person. That's kind of important. It's like my whole job is triangulation. Run it 3, 4, 5, 6 ways to see what we've left out, right? And then I would pass on copies of the 10K to folks in the room and say, go through factor by factor. By and large, nobody reads risk factor, which is, I think, a shame. In fact, the new SEC commissioner is even talking about shrinking that disclosure. So the idea is go through each risk factor and label them as E, S, G, and maybe others or something, right? And I've run this exercise many, many times. And it's quite interesting that maybe for an oil and gas company, maybe half of these risk factors would be either E or S. Mm-hmm. Now, you don't expect a CEO to say, my governance is terrible. So you don't see much about G, and that's something you do on your own. But that's kind of interesting to begin with, right? I mean, like half of these risk factors are E and S factors. And that's the beginning of the story.
That's interesting because whereas your students identify with that, it might be interesting to take yourself back into the company and say, do the companies that are actually producing those recognize that? And so that's interesting to me.
It's a fascinating comment because, as you know, there are so many silos in this world, right? So going back to my lawyer comment, so who does the CSO report to? If he or she reports to compliance, sorry, if he or she, reports to the legal guys, it's a compliance thing. If he or she reports to marketing, it becomes something else as opposed to the CFO.
That is actually a more common relationship, but that's shifting.
Yeah.
We're seeing that shifting. There's a lot of shifting going on right now.
And you know? I think overdue, frankly.
Yeah. The first 30 years of sustainability has gone through this journey of largely what I would call initially kind of a PR, public relations mapping, to a bit more of a compliance mapping. And now we're moving into a financial linked performance mapping. And I think that's necessary. But
a lot of it is the European hangover, right? Europe likes to top down regulate.
Yeah.
So then make it somehow write rules and somehow things will change.
Well, let's not forget, we almost did the same thing a few years ago. So things changed.
Things change. And frankly, now that it's actually very clarifying that there's not going to be much regulation in the US. Yeah. So that actually opens up space for innovation.
Yeah.
Meaning, A, you have to create value. Otherwise, nobody is going to give you 15 seconds of their time. B, forget the frameworks, I'd say. There are far too many, you know, it's an alphabet soup. We've discussed this over and over again. So let's progress with the story.
That's a great launching point into what I call the frictions, right? Mm-hmm. Where do you think companies today, given your students are able to do this mapping, conceivably, where do you think companies struggle the most today to make that link, to affect that link into hard numbers, you know, the revenue impacts, the cost impacts, the profitability implications, the cost of capital, these kinds of things you find in your finance, where are the frictions inside the companies happening?
It's partly, it goes back to the architecture of how a company is set up, right? I often argue the CSO has a longer horizon sometimes than the CEO and the CFO, which is inherently a difficult problem because many of the climate issues and so on are much like, you know, 7 years, 10 years, 15 year type horizons. So why are people not making these connections inside? It's partly how the firm is set up. Second, bit of a language problem, arguably. Lots of the CSOs, in my experience, are not necessarily finance people. They come from NGOs. They don't necessarily talk the language of finance. And I see this even at Columbia. You know, our climate school folks need to be taught that you live in a world of trade-offs. There's no free lunch, right? Everything we do in the business school is about trade-offs. There's no right answer. It's the set of second best alternatives that you're willing to live with. So I think it's partly a cultural disconnect. The talent pool comes from different places with different orientations. So part of the attempt behind Bob and my writing this book is to get CSOs to talk the language of finance.
Yeah.
Get CFOs to understand that CSOs are not just puffy PR do-gooders. There's actually some risk element here.
Yeah.
And hopefully, by getting these two parties together and integrating this closer with strategy and risk management and opportunities, generate some value in the process. I mean, so it's not about compliance. It's what a stock analyst should do. The other thing I often complain about, as you know, is that how come no sell-side analyst is asking about sustainability issues?
Well, we're going to come back to that.
Yeah, okay.
It's interesting you say it's not about compliance, but I guess in a regulated market, it drives that agenda a little bit more than an unregulated market, right?
Yeah,
argument to be made. There is some compliance aspect to this. But, you know, the other frictions you mentioned, time horizons, that's really interesting because CSOs, he's talked about 2050 and even 2030 is only a few years away. Let's put that in perspective for a sec. Time horizons are shrinking to the issue, right?
Yeah.
And so these things are starting to matter on shorter time horizons, which is an interesting dynamic between what you mentioned the CFO's time horizon interests are and maybe the CSO. So that's, I think, changing. And the language points you bring up as well, we find the same thing, exactly the same thing. A lot of the companies that we work with as WBCSD need that education foundation to change some of the ways in which we communicate these things. So we'll come back to that. But I go to a lot of conferences where we talk about disclosure, sustainability disclosure in particular, and rarely do we talk about just financial disclosures, if ever. But we talk a lot about sustainability disclosure. And there's disclosure fatigue. You mentioned this earlier. There's a plethora of disclosure regimes operating out there. The last conference I was at, though, I was introduced to a new group. And maybe you've heard about this group of people coming in through the finance organizations of their companies. They're ESG controllers that are actually being put in place to ensure integrity and quality and information. So I see this as kind of an interesting moment that's bringing these two universes, as we talk about, together. But let's get into maybe some solutions conversations about how we deal with this kind of mess. So if the core problem is this inability to map sustainability initiatives to revenue, margins, risk, and valuation, where do we see the most promising solutions? Is it in better data? Is it in getting rid of the sustainability disclosure regimes? Is it aggregation of those regimes? Is it financial accounting? I mean, where is it? Or do we find it maybe in AI? So over to you.
For the time being, I'm going to say AI because I'm infatuated with AI, and I'll tell you why. So let's take the classroom exercise a step further. So I would usually stop at labeling the E and the S and have the grand reveal that looks like 50%. But one has to take the next step. What does that mean, right? So for instance, if you're looking at an oil and gas company, again, to make this a bit more concrete, what would a carbon tax do? When would you take, when is the stranded asset problem really relevant? That's when you actually have to get deep into domain expertise, understand the accounting. And I'll give you a simple example. So if you're looking at one of these US oil majors, for instance, and if you take the number of years of production that's actually in the ground, that's around 12 years, say. So the stranded asset problem is a non-issue unless we believe that in 12 years, demand for oil and gas will somehow disappear. This is one way of making the connection. More often than not, the sustainability reports used to produce a bunch of KPIs, which I might say very few people read or internalized or used. And then the lawyers are writing these risk factors. All we are trying to do is make these elementary connections where you take the risk factors and then ask the so what question. What does it mean in terms of ranges of revenue, ranges of costs, ranges of liabilities that are left out? Use the KPIs in the sustainability disclosures. And here speculation happens because the accounting system is not good at two things. It's not good at scenarios, and it's not good at opportunity cost. Meaning we report what happened, we don't report what could have happened. And that there's a third angle. We also are terrible at reporting externalities, meaning bad things that I do in the process of making my product. That's why these two universes almost don't work together, because financial accounting is buttoned down, historical cost, it's about verifiability. I don't care about externalities. Sustainability is arguably everything that we've left out of financial accounting. It's about externalities. That's the whole double materiality idea. It's about ranges because it's about the future. I don't know. I mean, I can't put a precise number on what a carbon tax might look like.
Is the theory of change sort of both things have to evolve, financial reporting and sustainability reporting?
Well, sure. But I have very little faith in regulators, Bill. So I try to do it on my own. And this is where AI comes in.
We're going to come back to that as well. But you've talked several times now about your book, yours and Bob's book, I should say. You've also talked about just recently, just in the last few minutes, about this asking the so what question. And I know the big word in AI these days, at least to me, is prompts. You have to have the right entry into the problem you're trying to assess and the right way to structure the incremental entries to get finer and more granular understanding and knowledge from it. Thus the prompts. So you've now determined, I believe, and you can say more about this, that these prompts are key. But you obviously started with a very academic framing of what you thought the right prompts were. But I think you've done a handful of test cases now where you've actually explored this against real company data. Tell me more about these prompts, their evolution, and how these are going to be the game changer for how AI frame tools are going to help companies navigate this space.
I think the world of the future is going to be promptable jobs and unpromptable jobs. Okay, that's like a meta state. Management is about unpromptable problems. You know, how do you make a company profitable? The CEO figures out a strategy with the board and then writes a series of prompts where the gophers go execute, right? That's like that's the future in my view. So let's now think about these so-called prompts. What are prompts? This is again a place where the academic training is actually helpful. When you're a PhD, I often joke in class, I've never met an MBA who says, I don't know. It takes the humility of a PhD to say, I don't know. And what do we teach in PhD programs? The ability to ask the right questions. It's not about the answers. AI is full of answers. Prompts help you figure out the right questions. So you effectively need a lot of experience, domain expertise, to even start asking the right questions. And then once you write a series of prompts, going back to our simple case study here, trying to link the risk factors to the KPIs in the sustainability report, trying to speculate what these KPIs might mean in terms of future earnings, future cash flows, is the exercise. And AI boldly goes where humans don't go. I have, for example, have a hard time kind of, let me take the risk factors and figure out what does that mean for revenues or costs, like a carbon tax or a stranded asset problem, or in terms of human capital, if employee turnover is higher than whatever. These are hard problems, but AI makes it trivially easy. At least it gives you a scenario. It can run a bunch of simulations trivially and gives you a bunch of ranges. So that's the leap. Meaning, can we go from something legal, esoteric, abstract, risk factors, narrow them down to maybe the E and the S factors, and to make it a bit more interesting, also lay the SASB's topic of concerns about a particular industry to keep us focused. Then go find KPIs that might affect this, like a watch list of what you could probably look for. Then go pull out all the research in the world that I can find, linking, say, a carbon tax to profits. And this is actually a non-trivial problem because it depends on whether you're going to pass on the tax or not. If you're going to pass this on, demand curves are downward sloping, which means demand for oil may fall. So you need to figure out what is called the price elasticity of demand, and then you model that. AI makes all this super easy. I just now have to think the thoughts and know, of course, how to write the right prompts. And suddenly it opens up so many possibilities and scenarios that were kind of hard to think of before.
That's an interesting framing of prompts leading to maybe an unexpected outcome or result. Looking at the various industries that are out there, I'm curious how many you've been able to explore, because I know that's something you and Bob really want to do more of and get more companies to work with you on this exploratory framing you're doing. But what are some other interesting outcomes that were unexpected or not anticipated in some of these cases you've looked at?
Well, we're learning as much about integrated thinking as we are about AI. Because, for example, we would take the same prompts and run them on 3 or 4 or 5 agents and frankly get convergent but fairly different takes on the problem. And then we're now where we are at right now, going back to the evolution of AI workflow. You have prompts, you have running the prompts, which is trivial. And the real work begins in stage 3, which is quality control and sense making. And we are learning a lot through sense making and quality control. That is the new job going forward.
Yeah, that's the real intelligence part, right?
And it's like, Bob and I cumulatively have 80 years of, experience, at least broadly defined in business. Most of us, Bob spent more time in the real world than I have, but it's straining us to the limit, by the way. It takes that much effort. And I'll tell you some, if you want to give you some concrete examples. This is a bit technical. So in the oil and gas world, for instance, you take an impairment, meaning you write down the reserves when oil prices fall. This happened during COVID when oil prices fell below even storage costs, if you remember. But the way the accounting rules work, you don't take a write-up, meaning you don't increase the value of these reserves when oil and gas prices go up. So what does that mean? So if the AI is saying, oh, there's a fairly big impairment problem. No, not really. It's an economic problem only if oil prices do not recover. And that radically changes by billions of dollars the value at risk because of, say, sustainability. So and you were asking for other industries. We've looked at consumer products, technology, utilities. I mean, I haven't done this for like every company, but I'm reasonably sure you take any standard company's 10K, you look at the risk factors, the overlap between those risk factors and ENS issues would be at least 30 to 40%.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, we hear a lot, at least I hear a lot anecdotally about physical risk as a factor that companies are really trying to understand how they implicate the value of the company, right? I mean, if your asset, if you talk about stranded assets, you also can talk about assets underwater in both financial terms, but also physical terms. And that has the ability to shut down a corporation for periods of time. And that can also be in markets. I mean, market implications here are big deals when it comes to environmental impact. The nuance of building those bridges between those links and how, to your point, the tools that we have available to us today can really accelerate our understanding. And that's the key. It's not that there isn't real intelligence able to make those links. It's the informed intelligence that AI is giving us to accelerate the ability to get those links into the financial terms, right?
And to disintermediate people in the middle who are arguably either adding noise or just taking too long to do stuff.
I agree.
You know, I'll give you an example. I mean, I was talking to a CEO and he said, look, I don't need my middle management to interpret stuff for me. Now I tell them, give me the data. I'm going to stick it into four agents and I'm going to come up with my own interpretation. Now, of course, this person is an evolved CEO and not every CEO wants to do that. But that's possible now, which was impossible back in the day. You know, you'd write memos and waste a gazillion amount of time kind of crunching through spreadsheets. This is, in that sense, this is a revolution. It's going to redraw the boundaries of the firm. Meaning, why does a company exist? Because it's cheaper to do stuff inside than outside. That's going to change.
And the truly smart, most of them are sustainability professionals, will see the importance of their role shifting to being able to drive these, call them prompts, into the right engines to produce the results that the CEO would benefit.
Exactly. And it will hopefully help them a little bit to make the case to the CEO and the CFO that these are financial issues. Because I've heard the cliche being talked about over and over again. We have integrated reporting and ESG or sustainability is about risk management. When I would push them harder, what exactly do you do? I'd get wishy-washy answers. Part of the project was to go beyond the wishy-washy into something solid, concrete, verifiable, and useful and value relevant. So my ultimate hope and goal is that a sell-side analyst at some point will start asking deep questions about how sustainability relates to value.
So what's between you and in this potentially bestseller book that you guys are working on, you and Bob, what's between you and having that ready to go? I'll give you a moment to do a shout out, a call to action, because I know you're looking for use cases and test cases to build into your experience base, but over to you.
Yeah, we're almost done. And the idea was to initially put out a series of prompts that people will just go and test, hopefully, companies, anyone. You know, investors, analysts, students. And the hope was to improve these prompts, maybe customize them industry by industry, maybe run competitions, perhaps, for the best set of prompts. In fact, Bob and I were thinking of maybe running these YouTube video sessions, which a lot of the coders now apparently do, because the young folks want to understand how the so-called experts think and how they make mistakes. So we're going to run a series of these YouTube thingies where we just take a company that we haven't rehearsed, run this, look at what comes out of the system, do some sense-making, quality control. So the hope is, if nothing else, to create a community around integrated reporting and thinking, using AI, crowdsource improvements, because there's a limit to what we can do. Because our aim is to give this away and to change the conversation and hopefully elevate the discourse and make this all about value and risk and numbers and not about politics or going nuts about this or that pet cause.
Right. And that brings us right back to where we find corporate sustainability at these days, is that clarity of link that's necessary between the issues that the sustainability efforts are surfacing, whether that's decarbonizing, whether that's strengthening value chains, supply chains, whether that's addressing physical risk, against the investments the company's going to need to make for that, and against the performance that that will return to the companies having made those investments. That's where we find ourselves today. So Shiva, it's been a real pleasure. Our time has come. Let me just offer a couple of thoughts. I think we've really surfaced some great points today in the discussion and hopefully evolving some genuine interest in the work that you and Bob are doing. And so in whatever capacity we can make links to companies that want to work closer with you through this podcast, we will do so. I fundamentally believe AI is changing the world as we watch the world turn, and it has a real role to play here to really help companies to navigate these very critical issues. But I think the new frontier, and I encourage you to think about this with Bob, is going to be on the other side of the equation, which is how capital markets need to, in some ways, change their formula for how they bring these valuation metrics into the companies they're assessing. You said something about this earlier, and I think maybe there's some work you can start to do based on what you're learning on the real economy side of this equation for what you can do on the financial markets, capital markets side of the equation.
Yeah, you know, and you're right. I mean, and at Columbia, frankly, you know, I'm in a very blessed position because most of the analysts who go to work on the street either come from us or our competitor, NYU.
Amazing.
So the hope is to educate the next set of analysts to think a little more holistically about value rather than get obsessed with what's going to happen in the next quarter.
And this is a little bit of a great plug you're giving me an opportunity to make for the corporate performance and accountability work that we're doing at WBCSD, touching these sort of critical areas with our members that want to find real solutions and real guidance for some of these needs that are working their way through right now. So Shiva, thank you for your time today. It was a great opportunity to get into this with you. And thanks for being an impactful, transformational leader in sustainability and business leadership.
Thank you so very much, Bill.